Here again is John Hickman.
Two trademarks of the Meston script are violence and tragedy, and for a very good reason. John Meston.
Well, most stories do end rather tragically and sad, despite the propaganda in the great United States of America. No, most people in those days had sad endings, or a great number of them did. Jesus, it was a hard life. Didn't live very long. While they lived, it was pretty rough. And the brutality and the violence. We talk about violence these days. Of course, the stuff they put on television is terrible, I think. But the violence in those days was rampant. There, my God, the violence. Whew. And a poor way of life. You know, no medicine, no sanitation, no, not much of anything. A lot of heat and sand and little water, not much food. It wasn't a great life. It's been romanticized fairly well, but maybe that answers the question. I don't know. It didn't romanticize it so much.
Meston scripts are filled with odd and tragic figures, and one of the best examples is the guitar, first heard in December 1953. It's the story of a not-so-bright guitar-playing ex-soldier named Weed Pindle, who transports himself about the West on an old mule. Pindle, played by Vic Perrin, is bullied by two cowboys in one of the first scenes of the show.
Now, what in the world is that fella?
Who?
He just came in the door there with Tyler and Short.
Oh, him. That's Weed Pindle. He rode in on a mule a couple days ago.
Well, which has the bigger ears, him or the mule?
Oh, he is funny looking, all right. And he acts peculiar, too.
That's a mighty scrawny mule, Pindle. I seen you on him this morning.
Pindle here is kind of scrawny yourself, Short. Maybe some beer would fatten him up a little.
I'd like some beer, all right, but I got no money.
Why don't you sell that guitar of yours?
Sell my guitar? No, I'd never do that.
You must have a nickel, at least.
Last money I had got stole.
Now, who'd dare steal money off a tiger like you, Pindle?
I was asleep. I started to wake up, but they kicked me in the head.
You call that a head? Looks to me more like your neck just growed out and haired over.
I ain't very handsome.
You sure ain't.
Hey, what'd your old lady think of you when she saw you, Pindle?
I don't know. She died.
Yeah, laughing, I'll bet.
Oh, now, that's enough, Tyler. That's too mean. Pindle's a harmless little fella.
Ain't nobody talking to you, Chester.
Well,
bartender, three beers.
You buying, Tyler?
I'm proud to.
As the story develops, Tyler and Short ignore Dylan's warnings and continue to torture Pindle. They even mutilate his mule.
What do you suppose they've done to him now?
Look at his mule, Chester. Well, that's what they've done.
Oh, my goodness, Mr. Dillon, he's lost an ear.
I thought Yankees liked their mules that way, Short. At least I always heard they did.
I guess they're just no pleasing some men, Tyler.
You shouldn't have done that to my mule.
Well, it's the marshal again.
Did you men do this?
Now, Marshal, we ain't done nothing to Pendle.
Did they do it, Pendle?
I tried to stop them, but Tyler held me. Then they gave me my mule's ear, Marshal. It's right here. See?
Yeah. Turn around, both of you.
Turn around, I said.
Now take their guns, Chester.
Yes, sir.
Can't do nothing to us, Marshal. We didn't hurt Pendle, no.
I don't like what you did to his mule.
I got him, Mr. Dillon.
Now, Rhett, you can turn around again. I ought to cut an ear off of each of you, but I can't do that. So I'm going to do the next best thing.
Now, look here, Marshal. You...
Now, leave him there, Chester. Pendle, I'm sorry about your mule.
He ain't much of a mule anymore.
Well, you better go take care of him. And maybe these two will leave you alone now.
Poor mule.
Tyler and Short reach their sadistic pinnacle when they destroy Pendle's guitar. The next morning, the two cowboys are found murdered behind the Long Branch. In the closing moments of the show, Dillon talks to bartender Sam Noonan about Pendle's whereabouts the previous evening.
Sam?
Yeah, what'll it be, Marshal?
Where's Weed Pendle, Sam?
Oh, I just sent him out back for a bucket of sawdust. What do you want him for?
Short and Tyler got their throats cut early this morning.
Good.
I guess their smashing his guitar was too much for Pendle.
That's so. Oh, there he is now. Pendle, come over here.
Morning, Marshal.
Good morning.
Pendle, where was you last night?
I don't know. Here, I guess.
You don't know.
Now, wait a minute, Marshal. Pendle, where was you after they wrecked your guitar?
Well, I sat in the alley a while, then I come back here.
Yeah, that's right. And he was so broke up about his guitar, I didn't want to leave him alone, so I took him up and let him sleep on the floor of my room. That right, Pendle? Well, go on, tell him now.
Sure, Sam. That's right.
Are you trying to alibi for him, Sam?
Why, no, Marshal Dillon. But I care about him.
Some people care about me.
Who, Pendle?
He's just talking, Marshal.
Who cares about you, Pendle? Tell me.
Those men.
What men?
He means some of the boys that was here when he come back with his busted guitar, Marshal. They just told him how sorry he was, that's all.
I see. They liked his music, didn't they?
Yes, they did. They liked to hear me play.
Who was in here then, Sam?
Well, now, Marshal Dillon, you know how it is. I'm busy pouring drinks, and I don't pay no mind to who's here and who ain't. I couldn't rightly say it all.
Okay, Sam, I guess I can't beat the truth out of you.
Oh, now, Marshal Dillon, who cares about Tyler and Short? Dodge is better off without
him. There's a law against murder, Sam, and it's the same for everybody. And I'll be back later.
What are you going to do now, Mr. Dillon?
Well, I've done all I can, Chester. The whole town's just plain quit talking. Nobody knows anything.
Well, I guess they're all trying to protect Pendle.
Yeah, they are. But he didn't do it.
Well, who did then?
Well, if I could prove who did it, Chester, I'd have him in jail. Say, come over here.
Well, I declare, Mr. Dillon, it looks to me like he's leaving town.
Yeah, I told him he could go.
He looks funnier than ever on that one-eared mule.
Yeah. Well, Dodge treated Pendle pretty rough.
It sure did. Poor little fellow looks kind of empty like without his guitar, don't he?
Well, maybe you'll find another one somewhere. Anyway, they sure like to hear him play in this town. A couple of the boys in particular, I guess. Yeah, they liked it just fine.
Another Meston trademark was his factual treatment of the plight of the American Indian. He had good reasons for this.
Well, as I recall, or I've been told, we were about the first show that treated Indians as human beings, not just redskins, and the only good Indians, a dead one, and so on. Did a number of shows about that, and intermarriage. And, of course, the buffalo, yeah, sure. But I think we the Indians before that, as I remember, that wasn't around much before that. I never heard radio or anything. They were treated in the old way, you know, just Indians, they're our enemy and that kind of thing. I think Gunsmoke was, I've heard or understand, was the first show that really changed us somewhat. No, the white man, the way he treated the Indians, is a national disgrace. It still is. Goddamn concentration camps and everything else. Trying to destroy their culture the way we're doing now. assimilate the Indian, sure. The Indian can be assimilated, but he can't get a drink. Oh, no, it's a horrible thing. No, I'd say Indians are no worse than anybody else. Most of the white men out there were not nice guys. They're all a bunch of nuts who went west anyway, most of them. When you really get down into it, Jesus Christ, who'd go through that? Washington policy against the Indians is to wipe them out, sure. So the poor Indian retaliated a little bit and got a bad name.
Perhaps one of the better Meston scripts with an Indian theme was Sunday Supplement, broadcast in June 1956. This story concerns two New York writers named Sprigg and Bunker who come to Dodge looking for sensational stories that will thrill their eastern readers. The writers disturb a Pawnee burial ground and steal an Indian totem, causing an uprising that is brutally extinguished by the cavalry. Following the massacre, Sprigg and Bunker return to Dodge for the final confrontation with Dillon.
Hello, Marshal.
Get on, Bunker. You too, Sprigg. Now.
Well, all right. We saw it, Marshal. We saw practically all of it. It was exciting.
And with no help from you, either.
Oh, it was magnificent. The cavalry really got their own back this time.
What are you talking about, Bunker?
The Indians. The cavalry practically wiped them out.
What?
Yesterday, Marshal, just before dark. We were driving along the Arkansas and heard all that gunfire and commotion up ahead. And we got there just in time to see what few Indians were left running for their lives. They killed all but half a dozen of them, and they got that Chief Little Hawk, too.
You saw this, huh?
Oh, now, Marshal, we wouldn't be making it up, would we? And I might add that it's about time we saw something around here.
You know, Sprigg, I was talking to Doc Adams over there when you drove in. You know what he'd like to see?
No.
He'd like to see you and Bunker hung.
What?
And so would I.
What's the matter with you, Marshal?
Why did you tell me a soldier gave you that totem?
Oh, you found out.
Why did you lie about it?
Because you were choking me and because I didn't know what you'd do next. Or why.
Why? You men robbed a Pawnee grave. You stole a totem of Little Hawk's clan.
Well, that's all we took. Who cares about a savage idol anyway?
Little Hawk did. He went on the warpath.
Oh, nonsense, Marshal. Over a fool thing like that?
Marshal, you're not standing up for a bloodthirsty redskin, are you?
I knew Little Hawk, Sprigg. He was a good chief. He was a brave man and a peaceful one. Till you shamed him.
Well, he's not shamed now, Marshal. He's a good Indian.
Now you get out, both of you. You get out today. Enough men have died because of you. And you go back to New York. And when you get there, you'll write a story about a marshal who'd have liked nothing better than handing you over to Little Hawk. If he were still alive.
One of the things that gave Gunsmoke a lot of special color were the sound effects.
Again, Norman McDonald.
It had always been a rule of thumb in radio that there should not be any dead air, that people must keep talking. Well, we changed that, not because we deliberately set out to change it, but just because the people we were working with didn't talk all the time. So we had to fill it with sound patterns. We had three sound men, for the most part, Bill James, Tom Hanley, Ray Kemper, who contributed more to the show than anybody could ever imagine. For example, the boys on their own time realized that we were having trouble with live gunshots. So they, on a Saturday, went out with some equipment of their own and recorded shots on tape, with a 45 and with a 38 and with a 32 and I think with a 22. These effects then could be played directly through the line so that it didn't flatten out and become just a dull pop on the air. So we had, on a Mackenzie machine, I think the boys called it in those days, we had Matt's gun, and we always used a 45 for Matt, and for the other heavies, there would be a 38 or a 32.
So they lynched him. They done it. Why, you dirty dogs!
Wait!
This is the kind of thing that the boys did in order to make the sound better and in order to make it work more fully for the show. They also really worked on the smallest possible details, like Matt getting up and walking to the stove to get a cup of coffee. The boys knew exactly how many steps it was from Matt's desk to the stove, or they knew how many steps it was from the front of Matt's office to the jail cell. The one place that we cheated a little bit was on the walk from Matt's office down to the Long Branch. If we were running short on time, it was two steps across the boardwalk, five steps across the street, one step up on the other side, and then the doors. If we wanted to stretch a little bit, that walk sometimes became considerably longer. But the boys made the walk work because they used spurs for Matt. Whoever was walking with him would be without spurs, so you could differentiate between two people, Matt and Chester, for instance, walking down the street. They went into the whole bit of the squeak of the leather when Matt would mount a saddle. You could hear the stirrup leathers stretch and squeak. And we took time to play the sound patterns, which I think contributed in great part to the color and the feel of authenticity, if you will.
Mr. Dillon! Mr. Dillon, come here, quick!
Huh?
Look.
Yeah. Lynched.
Scared me half to death. I seen him hanging there.
It isn't a very pretty sight.
There ain't no horse around. Where's his horse?
Yeah, he probably stole it. And then they caught up with him and took it back.
Who do you suppose done it?
I don't know. And I don't know how we're ever going to find out. Well, come on. Let's cut him down. And get him into the ground.
You know, when they did horses' hoofs effects, for example, I can remember Bill would use one set of coconuts to depict our horses, which were shod, and they'd use another set of equipment if an Indian horse came up or something like that. And probably to the listener, there was no difference, but to them, there was a vast difference. And they would change background noises from one saloon to another. And they were punctilious enough that they had a different set of street sounds for the day and for the night. These fellows were really dedicated to their jobs.
Must have been easy for you, Delk.
Real easy, Marshal. It was kind of fun.
Fun? Killing that nice boy, fun?
Yeah, taking my time that way. What are you doing? Give me my gun.
You're not going to be needing a gun, Dunk.
Good man.
What'd you...
God! God! He sure never expected that, did he?
No gunman would, Kitty. But he's sure never going to forget it.
I became a challenge, I think, to the two sound men that were assigned to the program then, Ray Kemper and Tom Hanley.
Announcer George Walsh.
And as I remember, it was around the 4th of July because they had a firecracker. And during the middle commercial of the dress rehearsal, they decided they were going to shoot off this firecracker. Well, as anybody who's ever been on the air can understand, my only concern was not their firecracker. My only concern was how I could read that middle commercial and make it sound like I was at a regular pace, but I was really killing time so I'd have some time to play with when we got on the air. And they shot off the firecracker, and I just went right on. I think this may have impressed Norm MacDonald a little bit, because he was kind of surprised that it didn't stop me. But it really impressed those two sound men, because for the duration of the program, they tried every week to break me up at that middle commercial, during the rehearsal, of course. But they'd bring up a table full of equipment for the program and a table and a half full of equipment to try to break up Walsh in the middle commercial.
We had some high old times. They were funny. Howard McNear sometimes used to refer to Saturdays when we recorded them as Dirty Saturdays. Sometimes somebody would make an inflection in a line that would come out slightly spiked and colored. And from then on, no matter what you said, the most innocuous line became really a dirty bunch of words when they were not intended so. But these guys would spend hours working up a ribald sound effect or something of the sort, and then we would all dutifully collapse.
One of the nicest things of the Saturday morning table reading was when Parley Bear would arrive with two enormous boxes of goodies from Benish's Bakery, which was a marvelous bakery. And, of course, everyone would always complain that Parley brought the wrong kind of torts or the wrong kind, which would drive Parley up the wall, and Howard McNair would laugh. But anyway, it was a pleasant way to start out, and all of the members of the both the casual and the regular cast were such professionals that they could kid as they worked without losing emphasis.
Georgia Ellis recalls a particular Saturday morning when supporting player Vic Perrin appeared wearing jeans that were held up with elastic. Perrin reportedly had a special interest in another casual player, Gene Bates, who happened to be working this particular program.
He had sort of a kind of a secret crush on her. He was lusting through his script at her sidewise. In a nice, sweet way, of course. But Vic was standing opposite Gene Bates, and he was so impressed with her, you see, this kind of a calf-like thing. And she was playing a scene with him at this one microphone. I walked up behind him and pulled down his pants. With the elastic thing, I just pulled him down and went back and sat at the table. And there was Bill, you know, and Dana and everybody looking. I don't know what they thought of me and Norman looking out of the booth. And there stood Vic in his shorts. And he kept on reading his script. Actor as always. Jean just raised hers a little bit higher. And what I had hoped to be complete utter confusion turned out to be nothing more than Vic turning purple, but at the same time acting away, reaching down with one hand and pulling up his pants. Well, you see, I didn't see any part of this, except later on Vic said to me over lunch at Nicodell's, "Well, for heaven's sake, you might at least have checked to see if I was wearing underwear."
Actor John Daner was a regular member of the Gunsmoke Stock Company, and he, too, looked forward to those Saturday rehearsals.
Oh, they were the most happy, because, for one thing, we all knew each other, and once the show was established, and we were rather established as a group, we worked so well together. We knew what the other's reactions were going to be, and we felt at ease personally with each other. For instance, we'd come to work in the morning, and we wouldn't get down to the first reading for an hour. We'd be sitting around with Danish and coffee, jabbering, just having a marvelous time. And I mention that only because it is from this kind of intimate relationship with the other actors, the other people, let alone being actors on the show, allowed you a tremendous inner freedom, a relaxation, a feeling of comfort, that there was no tension at all.
In those days, it was an absolute ball. We'd do two shows on Saturday. We'd do one in the morning, go to lunch, and then do one in the afternoon. And the total, we'd probably start at 11 and be through by 3:30 or 4 or something like that. It was joyful. It really was. Everybody looked forward to coming to work.
I wanted to ride out to Odie Richards' camp that night, but Obie insisted on staying in Dodge. I wanted to ride out to Obie Richards. Excuse me, the reason I got screwed, because on this side I wanted to ride out to Odie Richards. Well, I'm a son of a bitch.
Yes,
you were.
I wanted to ride out to O.B. Richards. Ah! San Antonio. Well. Shit, I can't possibly do it now. Okay, all right, here we go. Now, goddammit. All right. Quiet, everybody. Jesus Christ, fellas. I wanted to ride out to O.B. Richards' camp that night, but O.B. insisted on staying in Dodge.
For years, Bill and I had a running gag where he'd say, hand me those handcuffs or hand me this, it's in the drawer. And I don't know what started it, really, but it became a running gag. As you'd have the sound effect of a drawer open, I'd say, here's the... Well, there's my... I've been looking all over for that. How did that get there? Or would you hand me my jacket or hand me my gun out of the closet? And I'd say, yes, sir, here's your... Well, who put my... What... I don't know why people put my things in... What's that doing there? And after this had been going on for many, many years, Bill said to me one day, for nearly 10 years, we've been playing this show, and you've been looking for something and found it. Now, for heaven's sake, what is it? And I said, it's right here in my pocket, and here it is, and you can have it. So he made something appropriately pithy in his comment, and we went, but... I couldn't have told you what it was. It just seemed like a good gimmick at the time. And it used to annoy Bill through Dylan, the fact that I always referred to circulars as circlers. And I'd say, new batch of circlers come in, Mr. Dylan. He'd say, circlers? Yes, sir, circlers. How do you spell it? S-I-R-K-L-U-R-S. And he would just groan. I came bouncing into the office one day all excited because there was a stranger in town. And Dylan wanted to know some particulars. And I said, well, he's some sort of Dutchman. He says, how do you know he's a Dutchman? I said, well, he talks funny and he comes from Europe or Asia or one of them towns. And Bill, who was easily broken up, said, Europe or Asia? One of them towns? Yes, sir, that's what he said. And then... The wonderful quality there, Bill would never pursue it. He would rise above Chester, and Chester talked Doc into helping him make a garden. And when Doc wanted to know what he had planted, Chester didn't know. He had just found some seeds and had planted them, whether they were going to come up flowers or vegetables or not.
One of the best running gags in the show is recalled by John Daner.
The idea would be that Matt Dillon would be riding along with Chester and a little... fellow of the town, a little guy who sort of always admired Matt, would just call out, hello, Mr. Dillon. Matt would answer very soberly, hello, John, and off he'd ride. And this happened time after time after time. Out of the blue, along come this little character saying, hello, Mr. Dillon, or hello, Marshal Dillon. And that's all he said. And sometimes, I remember now, Matt would be out in the prairie somewhere, isolated, way hell and gone out somewhere, and out of the blue, I would just walk up to the microphone and say, hello, Marshal Dillon. He'd just say, hello, John, and off we'd go. Pass it off as though, you know, it was the most ordinary thing in the world that this little guy should be out there among the Arapaho Indians.
We were doing a show called The New Hotel sometime in, well, I don't remember the date exactly. Let's say it was in 55. And it was one of those mornings where just everything was on a tilt. Conrad, at one point, broke up so much that I thought he was really just through for the day. Following whatever Bill ad-libbed or whatever Larry Dobkin ad-libbed or whatever John Daner ad-libbed, the sound man would ad-lib sound underneath to go right with it. The story of the new hotel concerns a hotel being built which is later destroyed by a fire, and it's a very dramatic moment, and the cue line comes up from Conrad, and the hotel is in flames in the background, and Rex Corey plays I Don't Want to Set the World on Fire, which, of course, broke up the cast completely for about 5 minutes.